Okay, welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are one of many such centers around the world. You can find all of the addresses on the back of our periodical. And each center is independent of all the others. Each center is made up of associates, if you will. And all of the activities found in any one of these United Lodge of Theosophists will be aligned with the Declaration. And rather than paraphrase it badly, I'd like to share it with you. It's a magnificent little document. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So to such an association grounded on these few profound principles, volunteers amass themselves, free thinkers who enjoy or who find heartfelt ties to studying the philosophy and then to applying it, and then stepping up their volunteerism to helping keep it before the public eye. And as was said earlier, all of the lodges throughout the world are governed by the intent of these few paragraphs. Here in Philadelphia, we have a core of volunteers, serious students, if you will, who keep the building and the activities going for anyone who's seeking the path to right living and the path to a true realization of the nature of self. On Wednesdays, the library in the front of the building is open. It's a reference library. It opens up at 5:15, and it stays open until 7:15. There are always volunteers there, ready and eager to help you look up any side issue that you want to, any philosophical basis for an inquiry in daily life that you might have. At 7:30 on Wednesday, the class begins in this particular room in a more informal style, I guess, than on Sunday mornings. This winter, we're studying The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. And again, if you want to come in a little bit early and read the part for the Wednesday night class and look over the reference for the class, you're more than welcome to. That study class ends promptly at 8:30. In addition, Sunday mornings, the building opens at 10:30. There is a meeting such as this morning from 11 to 12. And during the month of February, we are studying the facets of self-discipline. And facets call to mind certainly the honing process, the polishing process that would go on in developing the radiance of a diamond. This today, the 14th, we're talking about renunciation of self-interest. And next Sunday, February 21st, the topic will be self-sacrifice that does no harm. If you hear things during one of these classes, if you see something that interests you in the reference library, there are many, many ways that you can get straight line information to study at home in your private time. Before and after each of the classes, there's someone at the book table who's volunteered to help with purchases of straight line theosophical literature. You can look over any of the periodicals or magazines, little bulletins, books, whatever is available, and discuss it with the person at the table. You could also go online to the Philadelphia site, to the Phoenix, Arizona site, and you can avail yourself of the literature for home use, and it's even capable of being searched by key term search. So there's many, many ways for you to explore the philosophy and then to test it out for yourself. So, this morning we're privileged to have a volunteer who's giving a forum talk. The topic again is renunciation of self-interest, and this would be one way in which someone can donate effort in order to keep the efforts in Philadelphia ongoing. So no matter what the volunteer effort is, from the platform, from the book table, in the library, behind the scenes, with time, service, energy, money, whatever it is, all contributions are welcome. And all you have to do is talk about it with the person at the book table, and you too can join in if you feel that this is something appropriate for your own life. So without further ado, we'll have our forum talk.
Renunciation of self-interest. So just what does this title mean? I think we all know what self-interest is about. It's like I, me, my, mine. What does it do for me? All those good things are mine. I will only do it if I get something out of it. You get the idea, I'm sure. But what about renunciation? Well, the standard meaning is the formal proclamation that someone no longer owns, supports, believes in, or has a connection with it, them, him, her, or something else. Theosophically, what we endeavor to understand then is how to renounce the fruits of our actions, which is what Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita means when he tells us to perform actions as a renunciation. The polluting effect of an act is not in the nature of the mere thing done, nor is the purifying result due to what work we may do. But on either hand, the sin or the merit is found in the inner feeling that accompanies the act. In other words, what was your motive? Was it selfish or altruistic? One may donate millions in alms and yet not thereby benefit his real character in the least. It is very true that he will reap material rewards, perhaps in some other life, but those even will be of no benefit since he will still be the same. And another may only give away kind words or a small sum, because that is all he has to give, and be so much benefit by the feeling accompanying each act that his progress up the ascending arc towards union with Spirit as we're rapid. We find in the Christian Bible that Jesus of Nazareth, enforcing this view in the parable of the widow's mite, which he regarded as of more value than all that had been given by others. He could not have referred to the intrinsic value of the coin, nor to the act as thus measured, for that quantity was easily ascertained. He only looked to the inner feeling of the poor woman when she gave all that she had. No matter in what condition or what direction we see ourselves acting, we perceive how difficult it is to be true denouncers. And we cannot hope to reach the perfection of this better sort of renunciation through action in the present life, be it the one in which we have begun, or be it the 20th of such effort. However, we can try, and such is our duty. If we persevere, the tendency towards the right understanding will increase with each life more rapidly than would otherwise be possible. And even in the high aim found in aspiring to discipleship under a master, or even to adeptship, we encounter the same difficulty. This aspiration is commendable above most that we can formulate. But when we coldly ask ourselves, soon after that aspiration has been formed, why am I thus aspiring? Why do I want to be near, in sense, to the Master? We are obliged then to admit that the impelling motive for acquiring the aspiration was tinged with selfishness. In other words, self-interest. We can easily prove this by inquiring of our own conscience. If we had this ambition for ourselves or for the great mass of men, rich and poor, despicable and noble, would we be able to feel content when we suddenly told that our deep longing had given the boon to others and that we must wait 10 more lives? It is probably safe to say that the answer would be that we were very sorry. In the Bhagavad Gita, we find the remedy for the difficulty, as well as the difficulty itself, clearly stated. The right performer of action, abandoning fruit of action, attains to rest through devotion. The wrong performer of action, attached to fruit thereof, on account of desire, remains bound. But I lost the page here. These instructions will be very difficult for all who are living for themselves and who have not, in some small degree, begun to believe that they are not here for their own sake. But when we feel that there is no separation between us and any other creature, and that our higher self is leading us through all the experiences of life to the end that we shall recognize the unity of all, then instead of continually acting contrary to that object of the higher self, we begin to acquire the right belief and aspiration. Nor do we need to be deterred, as some are, by the extreme difficulty of eliminating the self-interest and the selfish desire for progress. That will be the task during many lives, and we should begin it voluntarily as soon as it is known, instead of waiting for it to be forced upon us through suffering and many defeats. From Mr. Judge, let us from the outset wash out of our souls all desire for reward, all hope that we may attain. For as long as we thus hope and desire, we shall be separated from the self. And from Buddha, resolve to be tender with the young, compassionate with the aged, sympathetic with the striving, and tolerant with the weak and wrong. Sometime in your life, you will have been all of these. Once again, dear hearts, the title for today's session is Renunciation of Self-Interest.
Thank you. It's a great title, isn't it? And the theme for the month, the whole concept of the facets of self-discipline, recalling in from the ancient writings that we reflect, we are a radiant of the diamond soul. It's our task to polish and polish. I'm sure you came this morning through the deep freeze with ideas of your own on this particular subject. Yes?
We'd like to follow up on that analogy with the diamond soul to remind ourselves that how many ages it takes that diamond to be even appear in its raw state from the pressure on just cold. Mm-hmm. How many ages before we can even begin to polish it? It gives us a sense of patience that we have to have for our own efforts to mm-hmm. purify that nature.
It's an excellent point. If we consider a diamond in the raw state was once organic substance and under tremendous pressure across many ages, gradually is transformed into the potential for a radiant gem. That's an excellent lesson, and one that Westerners probably need to know. You know, aren't we the population of instant soup and instant coffee and instant this, that, and the other thing? And like it or not, the childhood memories of lessons about you only live once, you're only in this physical personality once, that kind of pressure can remain behind the scenes in our thinking, unaware to us, and set up a pressure to hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, when the philosophy offers a tremendous peace of patience, of a process, of a journey, of an unfolding. You know, if we picture the Grand Canyon being created one drop of water at a time, if we picture the grains of sand on the beach and we're aware of they were once part of mountains somewhere, that process that unfolds across lives and lives is one that's one of hope, but one of tranquility and patience as well.
What point of view must we develop? Where do we stand in relationship to the self-discipline?
Where do we stand in relationship to the nature of self? If we use the analogy of the hydrologic cycle, the water cycle, and we know that a molecule of H2O can travel through an entire cyclic system, can't it? Depending on the conditioning of temperature and state, the molecule might be in a gas, a solid, or a liquid state. If we think about the nature of pure, fresh water, we know that there's a continuum there where the molecule may be resident in salt water or brackish water, polluted water, fresh water. That kind of correspondence is very similar to the nature of self. As thinkers, as perceivers, as creators, literally, we find ourselves like those molecules in any one of the status of water at some point of development, in self-consciousness. We can be very, very aware as self-conscious, proactive thinkers, and therefore very aware of creating. Or we can lead our lives and find ourselves from time to time really lost in a tremendous emotional state where we're completely enmeshed, we're completely identified with the personality, the conditions of that life, the tragedy, the trauma, the sorrow, whatever that happens to be, and we find ourselves curtailed or limited by that experience. So where do we find ourselves? We as thinkers look around the room and perceive that there's different points of consciousness, and we label those points of consciousness by name and descriptors and conditions, etc. But the philosophy teaches us that we find ourselves as radiance of one self. We can think from that point of view of the oneness of all, or we can allow ourselves to be enmeshed and think from the point of the view of the personal. Did that get to your question, or do you have a follow-up?
We must think about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a title from last month, Memory, Friend or Foe, we may try our best to be devoted to the interests of others, but memory seems to be against us quite often because it continuously brings before our mind the consideration of ourselves as personalities, continually bringing to mind what we want and things that happen to us. It's very difficult to forget the pink elephant in the room, to forget our personal selves. Is there a way we can begin to develop that kind of forgetfulness?
Well, fairly recently, I heard in this room somebody talk about making the mundane sacred, or raising the mundane and making it spiritual. We are moving as thinkers through an entire ocean of life, aren't we? There are lives and energies all around us. There's all sorts of karmic interactions in the body and out of the body. And then the overlay, certainly, of individualized past thinking and habit also conditions our experience. But we can at any time, turn our focus upward, beyond the body, inward. It depends on how we focus our use of mind and soul powers. So as memories may flood back to us, and we may, fall into a circumstance where the usual family tradition is to squabble and compete or argue about politics at the dinner table, and we find everything about us physically and emotionally on fire, we're all set to go, we have the capability of becoming aware, of saying, oh, there it is. There's that memory of childhood. There's the habit that's familiar. Now, do I want to engage in it, or is there a way to experience this in a better pattern? And in the very thought process of being in the moment and thinking about it, we're broken. We're no longer enmeshed in the memory or the circumstance. We're no longer conditioned by the external. But in the observation and thinking about it, we have stepped apart and stepped into a higher spiritual realm. Not perfection, but just a practice of stepping back, observing, and raising it. Yeah.
So the physical world that we live in is an effect state. Mm-hmm. So that a renunciation on this plane is not as meaningful if we renounce it in our mind. Say we renounce all self-interest. So, and it may not manifest right away, but if one dwells on that renunciation. Doesn't theosophy say that it's like sort of like water seeping through a sponge? It just sort of, you know, as long as we keep our self-discipline, which is mental, and trying to renounce self-interest, and in our mind try to work it out.
Mm-hmm.
Not in our body, but in our mind.
Mm-hmm. Well,
does that not see a result on this plane?
The results will come. The same way that that little drop of water, one drop at a time, created the Grand Canyon. If we are in a circumstance to think about the philosophy, if we are cool, calm, and collected during daily life, and we can recall statements that we've read or heard, shared with others in these rooms, where we're alert to, we're swimming through this incredible karmic sea of memories in nature, memories we've created, memories, habits, the three gunas that have been created by others, and that we're in constant motion mentally. We're bombarded in a certain way in the physical, in the emotional, in the mental realms by all these different influences. So those qualities are always there. The activity is always there. The pairs of opposites are always there. But if our practice, if our devotion is to try as we can in a calm moment to be aware of the influences, to see the effects of the activities, and then to begin to weigh and consider what would be the best course of action in this circumstance. What would be the best course of action to raise the circumstance to imbue nature with a better memory for the future? And in that way, we begin to take our thinking away from the limits, away from the personality, the delusion of separateness, and we begin to plant seeds of thought and growth for the future, for serving all. Way, way in the back.
We think it's also important to remember during that process what you had in mind, because it's rather like cleaning an attic or a basement. The more you begin to work on it, the more dust and dirt and old junk you sort of stir up.
Yeah.
And if you don't keep in mind that you set out to do that, that it was your goal to inspect these things and alter them, you will be easily discouraged.
Or better, it's been my experience, you start out to organize and you become mesmerized or focused on the memories involved with a particular object or book or whatever, and the next thing you know, everything is too priceless to discard. And again, it's a self-centered process. You forget, oh, I was going to clean up this room to benefit somebody in the family, and you become completely ingrained in this self-centeredness. But can we hop from selfish or focused on self-interest to altruistic? Yes.
HPB said quite clearly that altruism can be learned by practice. So obviously we have to take that whole central part, which is unselfish, not selfless, but begin to be more unselfish.
Yes.
If we examine how memory as a habit works in our life, as was pointed out, when we remember something, there's a whole lot of other experiences associated with it by memory. Well, we can take advantage of that aspect if we do have a memory of self-interest that comes before our mind, to immediately associate it with something we read in a philosophy or read in a devotional book or heard from the platform. And that impression becomes associated with it. So when it comes back in the future, so does the memory
mm-hmm.
of the high idea
mm-hmm.
Come back with it. And bit by bit, that memory becomes our aid.
Right. You know, that process of offering things up. We've heard many friends from different religious persuasions use the phrase, I'm going to offer this up to the Lord, however they see divinity. And isn't that the process that was just described, where we have a habit of thinking, or there's some sort of degree of self-interest that tinges our thinking, and we become aware of it, and we offer that up. Well, you know, whatever happens will be good enough, or is meant to be. And it is that duality of thought then that's coupled together and comes back. There's a wonderful article in Magazine Theosophy in volume 21. And this is a series of quotes from that article. The daily life of every man is crowded and chocked with experiences of every kind, from continuous interchange and reciprocal impressions and expressions on every plane of manifesting nature. So it's not only what we've generated karmically within our own sphere of influence, but we're interchanging with all other thinkers as well. Every conscious sensation makes an immediate mental deposit, a seed of memory, of imagination, which may lay dormant for ages, but which sooner or later, in this life or some other, will be impregnated by some polarizing contact of the enduring soul. It will germinate, and in its expansion from the energetic and moral center, the thinking center that was earlier alluded to, and it becomes a basis for a whole lifetime's experience of good and evil. Actual chaliship of any degree is the conscious admission or rejection from moment to moment of the impressions which throng the corridors of the senses, the conscious weighing before expression of every impulse to action of any kind. The eye incessantly wanders, the ear is incessantly open to every vagrant object of perception, except when fixed by attraction or by will. So when the comment was just made about generating that higher thought and transmuting the lower and planting that seed for the future that will come back lifted to a higher degree, that is what will be attracted back to us and back to everyone that we are influencing. For thinking, that power to think, that eternal activity, that constant motion of thought is something that we do for the all. That molecule of water that transmutes and transcends and transforms in all the conditions from salty to fresh does so for the whole universe, for the all, not merely for that one molecule. Yeah.
This brings back to mind the year 1774 and 1775, when the Confederation of 13 colonies got together and made a flag. That flag had a serpent chopped into pieces, and those 13 colonies were listed on each piece. They flew that flag in the face of the said, don't tread on me. Remember, me comes to mind. So if we think of our conscience, our sense of rightness, our moral nature, we have to say to those moments when we begin to fight against that sense of oneness and selfishness takes over, we have to hold our ear out and we'll hear something in us saying, don't tread on me, remember me. Mm.
And sometimes that selfishness is easier to see reflected in our companions than within our own behaviors. If we are too often acting by impulse or in reactionary terms. And our tendency is to attack or to get loud or to in some way argue to win the argument, to become a right fighter, if you will. Sometimes we're, as thinkers, we're blinded. That habit, that memory, and that self-interest is so ingrained in the makeup of the physical and the astral and the emotional and the mental that we fall into it. Sometimes the hints come when we see the activity or see the pattern in another. And we're caught up short. It's like, oh, how could so-and-so think like that? And then we're aware, oh, wait a second. That's the warning bell. If you can see it in that other one, turn the sight around. And in the evening hours when you're considering the day and looking at how, as a thinker, you use the process of life, that's when you can say, if I noticed this in the other and it bothered me so much, what does that mean about my own tendency and memory? And again, going back to the earlier comment, that process of awareness, bringing it home, meditating or contemplating on it, considering it, weighing it, imbues all thought and all degrees of substance with a much higher effort. If the motive is do no harm, serve the all, grow toward the altruistic. Yes.
Yes, indeed. And after the war and independence was discovered, what a fight the United States had in retaining that unity to come out with the Stars and Stripes. It's a picture of the battle we have every day of maintaining an independent attitude and a sense of right and wrong. Our government is established with that in view, and as a case, a point, consider our nation as compared to many. Do not express, at least in writing, constitution and so forth.
The study of government between the Confederation of 1775-76 and the Federation born in 1789-91 is all around us. I mean, we can look at that in many, many different ways as an evolutionary process of how to take high ideals and principles and then begin to formulate them into agreements by which one can live a good life and serve the all. And it's a process, and we know certainly we can see the process of developing an idea, planting a seed, testing it out, refining the idea, replanting the idea. It's ongoing, and it's part of life process as well. Yeah.
Well, the freedom won by governments and peoples on the outer plane can be lost. It can come and go. But once we've gained a bit of freedom from self-interest, is it ever lost?
Aha. Freedom from self-interest. Can it be lost or is it ever lost? Way in the back.
You can't unknow what you know. You may forget it for the moment, but it's still there influencing you and pulling you in a given direction. We think the most difficult thing about this subject is it is so hard. Where do we start? It's like looking into the Grand Canyon and going, oh, I'm supposed to fill this? Well, where do I start?
Well, it's also like looking into a room where everything is in total disarray. The bags and the boxes are piled high, and we're back to the image of trying to clean up the mess. Well, how do we do any of that? We do it one little thing at a time. A dear friend, once said, just do one bag. Just work on one bag. And life will present the circumstance that we need in the moment. Karma will bring it to us the moment we step out of bed and we start our public lives, however that may be, public within the home or public out in the street, at the workplace, wherever. Circumstances will arise, and in that moment is where we begin. We don't have to travel to a different country. We don't have to go pay for a particular course in self-improvement or head to the bookstore and buy a bunch of books. In the mundane, everyday experience of life, as we do each duty that's before us, the circumstance to think, to calm down and say, do I have mixed motives here? Is there something that keeps cropping up in my speech? I this, I that, or I have a special little group or self-interest. Am I talking about that a lot or thinking about that a lot? There's the beginning place. That one little package of moment, the rest will take care of itself. Way, way in the back again.
A bit of wisdom given to us at the start is find something for the week, a quote, a phrase, a paragraph from one of the writings that moves you, and begin your day every day that week with that. Read it, think about it, and try to use it. And then the next week, you're on to something else. It not only sustains you, it builds a knowledge of the philosophy itself.
Starting the day that way, with a point of reference, setting the tone for that day, and doing it for 7 days in a row, and maybe journaling at the end of the day, how did it go? What were the moods? What were the conditions? You know, what was the experiment like? Was I able to sustain something? Did an answer come to me in a radio show or a song or in a dear friend's comment? It's almost like putting a jigsaw puzzle together or a really good mystery story where, you know, we're always on high alert and always looking to work at something. And in that, the philosophy offers an endless array of hopeful circumstances and unlimited resources. In the back of the Bhagavad Gita, there's a companion piece where words are defined. And the word universe is one of the ones that's defined. A vast field of evolution, ruled by law, cooperative, balanced. A school or training program where the tiniest portion of intelligence, undefinable, is given the potential over innumerable ages of interaction to develop its innate wisdom into a docile personality. Choice, free will, and motive lead it to further advance to universal wisdom. So where do we start? We start where we're planted, right now, and feel secure that in the greater cycle, in the great nature of things, spirit or mind, however we envision that, that wills out. That's the beginning premise of all, and all other things will follow. Yeah.
Perhaps of renunciation or forgetting of self-interest is forgetting how far we have to go, how difficult the task is for us. And can be observed that even though it may seem to us that we've made very little progress and have a long way to go, the very little progress we make helps us so much in helping so many other people that we soon forget about how far, because the little bit we have means so much to other people who have no idea of how much they're limited by their own
It gets our mind off of itself. And in that, the Gita talks about a high indifference, that as we lead life, devoted to true yoga, true balance, true harmony, and we're not concerned about something that might happen 5 weeks from now or 5 years from now, we take our minds away from, I don't know, whatever the issue is in the public domain at the moment. But if we are wise and we restrain our thinking and take it off of all of these self-preservation worries, if you will, all the attachments to the fruit of actions, if we remain alert to the fact that the most basic action of all is thought, and that's the creative moment, we lay aside all the desires for anything mundane and personal. We have tremendous balance. There's a sweet peace of mind and a patience and an overview that things will come to pass in good time. And was said earlier that as long as the thinking, we make the effort to do right thinking, then all the other expressions of that will across time be built. But that elimination of self-interest, the desire to protect the personality or the immediate influence, etc., that's all for schnooking. It's really not going to take us anywhere. Yeah.
And because I'm a spiritual being, I get to do this. I get to dare to work and struggle to literally become like the Buddha. And so does everyone else have the same chance.
And we're told in a number of different places, you know, if the struggle to envision what the Buddha, the Christ, the Krishna is like, or there's a struggle to try to imagine the highest degree of the higher self, then don't. Focus on a bridge, a great master, a great teacher, an example of someone who is making the effort little bit by little bit to improve, to perfect. And truly, you know, when just thinking of ourselves as students of the philosophy who are generating materials on every plane of substance as best we can, as purely as we can, and making that effort to try to improve the substance of the universe and trying to improve the harmony of the universe, even in our little own backyard, in our own little garden. That process means that we're serving a tremendous theosophical movement. And we are in a situation where, although we are animal man, we are beginning to work toward the human state more fully, toward the spiritual state eventually. But in working all the substance, we're helping to create future substance that masters can use. It's a very, very lovely thought that no matter how tiny our effort, we're like the one drop of water in the canyon, just keeping at it, and the materials produced, a far greater enlightened thinker will be able to use them. Yeah.
And remember Admiral Perry on the Great Lakes, he sent a message back to Washington. He said, "We have met the enemy and he is ourselves." And if we can translate that into our own minds, with those fundamental propositions in front of us, we wake up and the room is full of those enemies who were hidden all the time until we began to struggle against them with those ideas in mind. Have no trouble if you're not resisting. But the minute you say, "I want to be do better by all, I want to overcome this personal self-conscious," that's mm-hmm. when the enemy lines up and can stretch from here to the other side of the world. What do? Do we say, "I won't fight"?
Well, there's tremendous hope. I found a little piece in the Gita notes. I believe it's in the section written by William Q. Judge. It may be from the Crosby section, but I think it's Judge. And you can check this out in the library hours if you want on page 34. We enter upon this great path of action in occultism, mentally disposed towards final victory. Now, there is attachment in that statement. This mental attitude instantly throws all the parts of our being into agitation, during which the tendencies which are by nature antipathetic to each other separate and range themselves upon opposite sides. This causes great distress, no kidding, with oftentimes wandering of the mind, and adds additional terror to our dark despair. At this point of our progress, we should examine our motive and our desire. So if we find ourselves setting a course of action that we've convinced ourselves, rightly or wrongly, you know, this is the altruistic right thing to do, and all of a sudden, all elements of the physicality in which we live is jangled, agitated, and we find all sorts of obstacles to whatever that course is, the invitation is to be devoted and to stop. Sit down and think, whoops, that may not be the path. What was in my motive? What was in my desire that triggered all that, that brought all those memories back? And how better can I serve? Yeah.
To go back to one of the previous questions or comments, that the hardest part of this is how to begin, how to begin the process. We're reminded of one of the virtues mentioned in the Voice of the Silence, indifference to pleasure and to pain. And one way we can begin is by every day, regardless of how pleasurable or unpleasurable the circumstances of our life may be, to put aside a little bit of time just to study the philosophy, just to make that a habit. It's an act of giving up self-interest, indifference to pleasure or pain, but it builds a foundation of thought, and without that, we can't begin to make the higher effort in a continuous way. It's that simple act.
That simple act of daily study, and you know what? When in life the experience comes that maybe there's a period of time where we've not been able to do that, it's almost having like a thirsty man who's just drinking ice water nonstop. The sensation of returning to a fine inspirational book and sitting quietly and studying a particular principle or rereading a particular passage is so such a relief. It's a sanctuary of a moment. And it's only sometimes after we've been away from it and we come back to the cycle again and renew the cycle again that we realize that there's tremendous power, not in the intellectual mental study pursuit, but in the focus of mind, the focus of soul powers, imagination, and all the rest, of being with the concepts of the philosophy. Very, very potent, very powerful, and one of many daily routines that are priceless. They're beyond compare. They cost nothing. They're very, very simple, but oh my God, are they priceless. And God in terms of the universal. Yeah.
It also becomes a focus of trust. We learn we can trust those laws, those principles. And Mr. Judge's, and it was Judge, if you think it's in the second chapter,
I thought so.
That we will have this separation and this difficulty of looking and seeing all the negative, but we don't always look at the positive. But that is the way the process will help us. If we don't see what's wrong with us, how can we ever fix it? So it's a blessing at the same time. It's a difficulty.
It's a blessing, and it's only upsetting if truly a memory of early thinking has handicapped us. What I mean by that is those of us who were raised with the notion of original sin, or those of us that were raised that man is a lowly worm and God is this external personal entity, there are certain drivers that are used by parents and teachers frequently in that circumstance. Be stronger, work harder, you know, work faster, be better, be cleaner, be, you know, whatever it is. It's the old clothesline wars of the 1950s, competition. And if we can put that aside and say, wait a second, that's not what it's all about, then everything that you just said is such a gift that we give to every degree of substance that we are using as thinkers, that we radiate the thought engendered in this room this morning by all of us together as a united force is radiating out through degrees of substance to touch, we don't even know whom is seeking, who might be attracted to this, who might need these very answers and these very sweet passions, spiritual passions. And we do great service in that way. Uh-oh. Yes?
Oftentimes, it's near to impossible. Well, our lower natures are like that. So perhaps we need to let the lower nature quiet down before we start trying to discipline it.
Yeah. You know, when the lower nature is on fire and seems to be almost in a camelopic state of experience, and mind, we've allowed mind to become totally imbued in that, and the mind thinks it's that entity, then there is a need for a timeout. The same way we would give a screaming child some privacy and timeout to recollect themselves, we say. And isn't that the spiritual process? You recollect the fragment itself that's been destroyed by this tsunami of emotions. And then gradually, when the child or the lower self is back into self, into line again, then we have that faculty within us, that spiritual faculty of being able to identify with the thinker, being able to identify with soul, and getting a better understanding, a spiritual understanding for our thinking. At that point, there can be a dialogue about free will and choice, about living in a better way. You can help the child analyze what just happened in the same way that we can lead our various sheaths of life through that same process. Yep.
Yeah, but to do that, don't we have to identify in ourselves that which is unchanging? That the witness of all this change, and is that not the process we need to try to unfold of who we truly are?
That's a wonderful practice. It's from the Mandaka Upanishads, the shaving process, where we in contemplation shave away, I am not this, that, the other, and you continue with all the things until finally everything is eliminated except for the self, for the soul, for the purity. And it is said that if while awake we take that spiritual basis for our thinking, that which compels us to right action, with the recognition that all men coming from the same source and proceeding toward the same goal, though the path varies with the pilgrim, thinking and acting on that basis during our daily lives, then the brain becomes more responsive to those other forms of consciousness during the sleep of the body. And we've begun to polish the diamond a bit more. Our time's up. Have a great week. Polish on.